All right, it is great to see each one of you here. This is the second session, the time we've gone through this, and the glory of God and the cross of Christ. And just a little bit about me. I've taught here since 2007. Before that, I was about 17 years in pastoral ministry. I was a youth minister and then a senior pastor in Oklahoma and in Missouri. So several of you I've already found out are from Missouri area. And so that's where I've been. I've got my wife, Rayanne, and two kids, one of whom is at the conference. I've got a 9-year-old and a 15-year-old daughter. And if you want to make contact with me or something like that, I put my Twitter up here, is Timothy Was Here. And so I always encourage people to tweet during the session. And if there's something that strikes you, that's the best way to remember it and get it out to other people is to tweet during the session. So that's what I tell my students is use Twitter and Facebook all the way during teaching time as long as that's what you're putting on it. So anyway, so it's a good way to remember things. It's a good way to actually interact with other people on ideas that come to your mind. And it's a good way to preserve them. So Timothy Was Here is who I am on that. And so feel free, at least in this session, to do that. Other people may have different perspectives on that and do things somewhat differently on that. Let's go ahead and jump into these materials. I want us to think about, we'll dig a little bit more into this word later on, but this conference really is about apologetics. That is to give an answer, and that's what the very word apologetics has to do with, is giving an answer for what you believe. Now, I want you to understand there's two things I've got to convince you of or work through you with in this session. The first one I've got to convince you of is the cross is something you need to give a defense of to begin with. Because in many ways, the cross has been pushed to the background almost, that we don't see it for the offense and the terrible thing that it really was. So that's one of the things, is I've got to demonstrate to you that it's something we need to give an answer for. But then I've got to show you also how that we do give an answer for the cross of Jesus Christ. And how do we help people understand what the real meaning and the importance of that is. We're going to look at the glory of God and the curse of the cross. Now let's take a look at some scriptural texts that I really believe that at the end of this session will make more sense to you than they did at the beginning, and that's my goal, is we're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 beginning in verse 17, and I believe at the end of this session that this text will make more sense to you than it does right now. So if you'll go ahead and take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and beginning in verse 17, hear these words from the word of the Lord. It says, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel." And what's happening in the church at Corinth is some people were, based on who baptized them or who was connected in them coming to faith, they were boasting in that. So Paul is saying, "Oh, I thank God that I didn't baptize any of you because you'd be trying to claim to be saved in my name instead of in Christ's name. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart or turn to nothing. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom, but what we preach is Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, a scandal to Jews, and folly or foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Let's pray and then dig into these materials. God, we thank you that you have saved us not through what we could do or what we could imagine or dream of, but you have saved us through that which is far beyond anything we could imagine, such that we know it is your power by which we are saved and not we ourselves. We praise you and ask you to bless this time, not bless it for the sake of any of us to be remembered, but bless it in the sense that you are remembered and that you are glorified. We ask these things in your name. Amen. Let me tell you about a man named Bill. Bill, I end up meeting with at Starbucks once in a while. We don't plan out our meetings or anything like that. It's just we happen to run across one another. And Bill is not a believer in Jesus Christ. He's probably late 70s or early 80s, and I've been trying to witness to Bill. And the fascinating thing about Bill is this. Every time I try to go toward Jesus and the cross in conversation, he always finds something else for us to be talking about. Always finds something else to be talking about. In fact, Bill, kind of his religion, he told me this morning, I saw him this morning and kind of talked to him a little bit this morning, and earlier this morning, and he said to me, he said, sometime I'm just going to write out my whole religion for you so you can just read it. And his whole religion has to do with his personal faith he's kind of created for himself, has to do with his capacity that he believes is some sort of a divine thing or something connected to the spiritual realm that he can do things with animals that other people can't do. Like he told me one time, I went up to an elk and petted it. That was when I was trying to talk about Jesus. And he said, you know what? I went up to, now think about this. Bill would rather talk about elk petting than to talk about Jesus, okay? That's basically what it comes down to. And this morning, as we were talking, he said, you know what? There's a crow. And this crow, it looks like all the other crows, but when I make a sound, it makes the same sound back to me. And he starts talking about this spiritual connection he believes he has with all these different things. Now, what's funny about that is that, it's simply not funny, it's striking, it reveals the heart of humanity, I guess. And it's that, as human beings, we would rather, in our flesh, we'd rather talk about elk petting than deal with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, we really would. It doesn't come naturally if we really understand it because it's offensive to us. But here's the problem. In many cases and many times, we don't catch how offensive the gospel is because we don't proclaim it clearly enough for it to be offensive. And so we have to add other things to try to make it offensive or raise the standard when really if we proclaim the truth about Jesus, that is offensive in and of itself to all of the things in our human nature. Because what it communicates to us is that saving me is not in my power. Saving me is in God's power, and it is his work. And one of the ways that we see that is in the cross of Jesus Christ. Now, in this text that we read, it talks about the cross being foolishness. There's a couple of words that are used in the ancient world to describe crucifixion as Christians are proclaiming it. And they are mania and moria. Mania and moria, okay? Mania and moria, both of these words are used at different times. What do you think mania means? That word right there. What do you think that means? Any ideas? What do you think it means? Mania. We know it as mania is what it looks like to us, that Latin word. But what does it mean? What do you think it means when they're speaking of that? Crazy. I heard somebody say it. Crazy. You got it. Exactly. Crazy. Crazy. Absolutely nuts. It's craziness. In other words, what it's saying there, and this is from Justin Martyr, who was martyred for his faith in the middle of the second century. He talks about how the world around him views the idea of a God going to the cross, views that as craziness, insanity. The word that Paul uses in the text we just read is moria, moria. And moria has to do with foolishness, okay? Foolishness is what it has to do with. We get the word moron from that. Foolishness is what it comes, some of the terms that are used there. I want us to think about this because Justin Martyr, this one in the second century, talks about it this way. He says, our insanity consists of the fact that we place after the unchangeable and eternal God a crucified man. Oh, the demons. And he's speaking there of that how he believes that the stories of the gods are demonic in origin. He says these demons have told stories of Zeus's sons ascending, but in no case has there been anything like crucifixion. Now here's what you see in that. That was absolutely unique in the ancient world. The idea of a crucified God was absolutely unique in the ancient world. Nobody else is talking about any such thing as this. And in fact, in a letter to the emperor from about 112 AD, it speaks of this. It says, Christians, what they believe and what they practice is perverse and extravagant superstition. Why do they believe that about Christianity? Much of it has to do with the cross. Now notice this, the cross is highly offensive to the world then. But look at us today. For us, the cross can function as a backdrop, a background, a piece of jewelry, and I'm not saying those things are bad, but the cross is not offensive at all. Nobody looks at us with a cross and says you're foolish and you're insane because of the cross. And the reason for that is we've lost touch with what the cross is really about. We've really lost touch of that. So I want to look at three different things and then pull some kind of things together from that. First off, the cross in Greco-Roman perspective, from the Greeks and the Romans, what the cross looked like from Jewish perspective, and then look at the cross from God's perspective. So let's take a look. From Greco-Roman perspective, that is the Greeks and the Romans, the Gentiles of the first century, here's how they would have viewed it. A symbol of the power of Rome and an instrument to shame anybody who dares defy Rome. It was an instrument to terrify people. It was something that was viewed by them in vulgar terms. We'll unpack that a little bit more later, but they viewed it in such a way that this is a way to terrify people into respecting the Roman Empire. Now, the cross in Greek and Roman perspective, the Romans didn't invent the cross, but they perfected it. And they used it to terrify people, to set forth on people that you don't dare defy the Romans. Originally, probably, crucifixion was a way of appeasing the gods. In other words, the belief was that that the gods were upset because you dared to cross Rome. And because the gods are upset, we're offering you as a sacrifice to the gods. In fact, if you were a Roman citizen, you couldn't be crucified except for revolt against the empire, if you're a Roman citizen. That's why Paul, for example, was beheaded while Simon Peter was crucified when they were martyred. It's because Paul was a Roman citizen and Simon Peter was not, and therefore there was a distinction there. So if you were a Roman citizen, they would not crucify you. It was a sign of shame reserved for slaves and revolutionaries. And so for Christians, they began proclaiming that they worship a God who has been crucified. Now think about that for a moment. We lose the offense of that. Now let me put up a few more things, and some of those are a little bit kind of grotesque, but I'm not doing this just to gross you out. I'm wanting to show you this because of the fact that I want you to understand what really was going on in crucifixion. This quotation, for example, from an earlier time from Seneca, he speaks of what he sees at a crucifixion. He says, "I see the stakes there, not of one kind, but of many. Some victims are placed head down, some have spikes driven through their genitals, others have their arms stretched out on the gibbet," and he goes on and on and on and describes all these horrific things that are going on at crucifixion. Think of this. This is what's going on. They were trying to come up with creative ways to kill people. Did you know people did graffiti in the ancient world, just like they do now? Go up and make something to make fun of somebody or something like that. Here's a bit of graffiti, probably from the second century, from the Palatine Hill in Rome. This says here in Greek, "Alexamenos sebete theon," is what it says. Now, interestingly, even in their graffiti, they actually misspelled things at times too. Sebete should be actually sebetai, so it's misspelled. But what this means, "Alexamenos sebete theon," what that means is Alexamenos worships God. Now, there's somebody named Alexamenos somewhere in Rome at this time, and this young man named Alexamenos worships Christ. And so somebody takes the time to put on a wall graffiti about Alexamenos and saying, if you worship a God who's been on a cross, you might as well be worshiping a donkey. That's what he's saying. That's why they placed it in that way. Now, you see how they view crucifixion at this time? Did you know that the word crucify functioned as a bad word in the ancient world? There's one incident in a Latin text in which there's this really nasty incident between these two that I won't go into, but this woman says to a man as he walks out the door, "Go get yourself crucified." It's one of the nastiest things she could say to him. The verb form, using it in that way, in fact, you know, one of the reasons you know that is because they use all sorts of substitute words or euphemisms to keep from saying crucify in polite company. Just a handful of the euphemisms that they used were infamous stake, the barren place, a criminal beam, the extreme penalty. What they will do is they will come up with all these different words to try to avoid saying that one in polite company because it's so nasty, it's so vulgar, so awful in the way it is perceived. In fact, among early Christians, there were some of them who developed a belief called docetism. Docetism means, the Greek word dokeo means seems like. And what docetism was the belief that Jesus surely wasn't really a human being who died on the cross. He just seemed like he was human, and he didn't actually die on the cross, and it must have all just seemed that way. There were people who claimed to be Christians who came up with that. What were they doing? Why were they coming up with that? The reason they came up with that is because they didn't want to deal with the idea that God himself really took on human flesh and went as far as the cross. Now let's look at it in Jewish perspective. From a Jewish perspective, the cross would have been a sign of God's curse and a symbol of being cut off from God's people. It was a sign of God's curse and a symbol of being cut off from God's people. It says in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 21, you may have read this text before, but it helps us understand their perception. Deuteronomy 21, 22, we read, "If a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he's put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance." Now, often in the ancient world, not just among the Jews, if somebody was executed for a crime, they would hang them up, and they would hang them for the purpose of showing everybody else, don't do this. Don't do what they did. Don't get yourself in the same situation. And it was a way of showing that. But God's law to the Israelite people said, don't leave them up all night, because the curses that are on my people when they disobey my law, those curses are on that person. And so bury them, have it over with, place them in the earth, lest they be literally hanging over the people in that way. Now, so the person was symbolizing, or was, and they were hanging there, they were a sign of God's curse for people who had disobeyed his law, and they became a symbol of being cut off from God's people. Because if they had rejected God's law and been put to death, they were in some sense cut off from being part of God's people. So that's what it was from the perspective of the people then, the Jewish people. It was a sign of God's curse and a symbol of being cut off from God's people. A hanged man was considered to be cursed by God. Now let's think of that. When we consider this, that from a Jewish perspective, it's a curse and it's being cut off. From a Greco-Roman perspective, it's something so vulgar they tried to avoid even speaking about it. It was nasty. It was disgusting to them. And yet, what is it from God's perspective? Think of this for a moment. Just stop and meditate on this. That this, which was the darkest and nastiest thing, God turned it into that which he used to show his glory. Think of that. The darkest, nastiest way. Nobody is going to make this up. We'll get to that before we conclude, but I want us to see that if you are deciding, I'm going to come up with a new religion in the first century, I'm going to come up with a new religion, develop a brand new religion, I'm going to try to get everybody to join my new religion, you would not choose, under any circumstances, a crucified God in your religion. You wouldn't choose that. The only way that could possibly be the case is because it really happened. It really happened. Nobody's going to fabricate this. There's no level at which somebody is going to make up a religion in which somebody goes to the cross. And yet in the cross, God first revealed his glory as a perfect king. He revealed his glory as perfect king. There's this great play on words in John chapter 3. We're all familiar with John chapter 3, verse 16. We all see it at the baseball game. There's always that guy at the baseball game who's looking for somebody named John in row 3, 16. And he's always out there, there. But we don't think about sometimes about row 3, seats 14 and 15, the one right before that. So let's look at John 3, verses 14 and 15. There's this really interesting play on words that helps us understand something about God's perspective on the cross. It says there, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life." Now that term that's translated lifted up, one of the meanings that that has is to be exalted. And in light of the overall picture in John, what's helping us understand in that is that Jesus being lifted up on the cross, part of that is that he is exalted. That is his exaltation. Think of this for a moment. I mean, just put this in your mind. That we would think, if we were coming up with a God to come to earth to be a king, how would we exalt him? We would exalt him with all sorts of gold and throne and all of that. And God God says, the way I am showing myself to be exalted is on the cross. That's how I'm showing myself to be exalted. Now, I want us to think about this in light of the Scriptures as a whole. Remember, all the way back in the Old Testament, the beginning of the Old Testament, Adam and Eve are given charge of the garden. Remember the story there. They're given charge of the garden. Part of what they're supposed to do in the whole be fruitful and multiply and all of that is part of the point of that seems to be is that they are supposed to fill the earth in such a way that God's glory fills the earth as the waters fill the sea. Okay, that's the idea, is that they will, in some sense, expand Eden all the way around the globe. And, of course, they fail in that by taking from the tree that which God has said not to take. So, in other words, what Adam is saying in this is, I will be the king over all this, but I will not serve under the king above me. See, that in essence, Adam and Eve are made vice regents or vice kings. That's what God has said. You rule, you do this, but you serve under me. And Adam said in the beginning, I will not be that kind of king. I am going to be the supreme king. I'm going to be the king. I'm going to take charge of that. You shall be, the serpent said to Eve, you shall be what? As God. You shall be as God. You can be that level. Now, what does Jesus do to undo what Adam did? What Jesus does is he goes to the tree and he suffers the penalty. And he becomes the king that Adam was not. And he does this in such a way that he submits to his Father. And so in that, God reveals his glory as a perfect king through the cross. By what Adam should have done as the vice king serving over the world and tried to take God's place. Jesus is rightly God. And yet he goes to the tree and he suffers the curse, the punishment. Leads us to the second one. God revealed his glory as righteous judge through the cross. God revealed his glory as righteous judge. Paul writes in Galatians chapter 3. Paul says in verse 13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. And he quotes then, that text from Deuteronomy, cursed is everyone who's hanged on a tree, so that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. And what Paul's saying right there is that Jesus Christ allowed himself to be cut off from the community of those who were in covenant with God. He allowed himself to be cut off from that for the sake of redeeming those who deserved to be cut off. And so God reveals his glory as righteous judge. On Jesus is poured out all the curse for humanity's sin upon Jesus. All the curses that at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, back and forth, the Israelites said, here are the blessings if we obey God, here are the curses if we disobey. And they disobeyed him, and on Jesus is poured out all the cursedness of all creation, all the cursedness that had been, that Israel rightly deserved, and all that we deserve who are not Jews, who have also rebelled against what we know about God. The third and last of these from God's perspective is that God revealed his power to share in our suffering through the cross. He revealed his power to share in our suffering. One of the things that we can overlook sometimes because we view the cross, and it is this, that God himself takes the punishment for our sin, and that's true. There's something else, too, that you never suffer alone if you are a child of God. God himself has shared in your suffering, in your victimization, in your struggles, in your loneliness, in your pain, that God himself shared in that. On the cross, all the forsakenness, all the brokenness, all the sin of all God's people is poured out on Jesus. God himself has used his power to be able to share in our suffering. God revealed his power to share in our suffering through the cross. Now, why does the cross matter when we are called upon to give an answer for our faith. We talked earlier about the word apologetics, and that word simply means giving a defense. Originally, what the word apologetics functioned as is it meant simply giving an answer in court when an accusation is brought against you. And so that's really what it is. It's when the world brings an accusation against your faith, how will I answer? Now, why is the cross so important for defending our faith? Well, it's this. It's because the primary aim of Christian apologetics is not to prove that your church is right. It's not to prove that you're right. It's not even to prove that Christianity is right. The goal of Christian apologetics is to testify faithfully to the integrity of the gospel, and the cross stands at the center of the gospel. That's what it is about. Apologetics is about testifying faithfully to the integrity of the gospel, and the cross stands at the very center of the gospel. See, the gospel is simply this. The gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, by which he has accomplished all that is necessary to establish his kingdom, to make sinners right with himself through faith, and to unite justified sinners with himself. The gospel is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, by which he has accomplished all that is necessary. He's not simply made it possible, but he has secured these things to establish his kingdom, to make sinners right with himself through faith, and to unite justified sinners with himself. And the cross stands at the center of that. It is the death of Jesus Christ by which he secured these things. Now, when we are trying to defend our faith, I think it's helpful to put up this diagram right here that has on it the four movements of God's story. So the four movements of God's story are creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. Now, I know those are big words, and everything like that. So let's break it down a little bit more. All right. Actually, everybody, kind of get your arms ready. I'll do it with you like I do it with my kids, my first and second graders at Sojourn. Okay. So just kind of do this right here. Okay. That's God made the world good. Then it's sin made the world groan. Jesus broke the power of sin, and God will make the world new. Okay? That's simply it. That's those four movements. Let's put it in a much simpler way. God made the world good, sin made the world groan, Jesus broke the power of sin, and God will make the world new. Now, what I want us to see is that it's by the cross that Jesus broke the power of sin, and then he demonstrated how he broke sin through the resurrection. But when we are trying to defend our faith, sometimes we can get caught up, for example, in creation. Now, there's all sorts of challenges and discussions that are good to have about God's creation of the world. But do you know what? You can convince somebody of your view of creation, of God creating the world. You can convince somebody of that and them still be no closer to Jesus Christ. So when we are talking about creation, you know where we need to head? Toward the cross. Toward the cross. We don't just camp out there. We need to head toward the cross. Fall. The fall of humanity. You can get all caught up in talking to somebody about why is there evil in the world. And you know what? You can give them all sorts of reasons that there are evil in the world. And maybe even convince them that there's good reasons for evil to exist. And then still really be no closer to Jesus. Now, are those good discussions to have? Yes. But they're ultimately only solved and understood through the cross of Jesus Christ. Consummation, the end of time. You can convince somebody of a certain view of the end of time, because people want to talk about the end of time sometimes, okay? And you can have them convinced of a certain view of the end of time, and yet, at the end of that, then still be no closer, really, to Jesus Christ. You see, everything we do has got to aim toward the cross of Jesus Christ. Or we may win an argument, but the person is still lost. The person is still lost. That's part of what it means to be gospel-centered, is for us to always make a beeline for the gospel at which the cross stands at the center in every time we are defending our faith in Jesus Christ. I want to suggest that the story of the cross and the empty tomb is a story that is too strange to be fictional. I'll kind of draw things to a close with this I think it's so important that we understand this. I've already pointed out that in the ancient world, if you were making up a story about a religion, and you're saying, I'm going to fabricate a religion, like sometimes people accuse Christianity of being a fabricated faith, you're not going to include a cross in it. You're just not going to. But there's some other things that ring true about the Christian faith that I think are very important that are rooted in the cross and the empty tomb. Now, let's suppose you're in a courtroom. I hope that none of you are anytime soon or recently in the courtroom, but let's suppose you are, okay? Now, there's two types of stories that raise suspicion if you're in a courtroom. One of them is, if everybody that comes up as a witness says exactly the same story in almost exactly the same words. I think these people have gotten together beforehand. They've kind of made this up beforehand, okay? So if they all say exactly the same words, you got a little bit of question. On the other hand, if they contradict one another, or it's just very vague, you're going to have some questions about it. The strongest testimony is when you have multiple people who tell basically the same story, that it has some certain details that nobody's going to make up that they share, but they all tell it in their own words. As it turns out, that's exactly what we have in the New Testament. It's exactly what we have. I want to look at four very important testimonies in the New Testament. One of them is 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This emerged as what's called an oral history. That means it's passed on by word of mouth for a period of time before it's written down. And it has crucifixion, which we've already seen. Nobody's going to make up. It must have happened. Jesus raised on the third day, and many people saw him alive. Okay? 1 Corinthians 15. You have that one. You have Mark 16, which is adapted in various forms in Matthew 28 and Luke 24. It has crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, and a really important little detail. Mary Magdalene as witness number one. What's the big deal about this? Do you realize that in a Jewish court, a woman had no valid testimony in the ancient world? In a Roman court, she only did under certain circumstances that were unique. If you're going to fabricate a witness to the resurrection, you won't fabricate Mary Magdalene. You're not going to make that up. But if that appeared in only one text, we might say, okay, just coincidence. Maybe there was another reason. But John 20. John tells the same story, but in very different words. In fact, he doesn't seem to even be working at all from Matthew, Mark, or Luke. John is on his own in this, probably isn't even aware when he writes of Matthew, Mark, or Luke. In fact, almost certainly isn't. And yet in John, with him telling it in his own words, you have Jesus crucified, raised on the third day, and the same first witness, who's an unlikely person to begin with. Now, as if that weren't enough, you've got one more as well. There's a papyrus found in Egypt called Papyrus Cairo 10759. It's sometimes called the Gospel of Peter. It didn't come from Peter. There's no chance it could have come from Peter, but it's what sometimes it's called because of the perspective it takes. But Papyrus Cairo 10759, I don't think it ought to be in the New Testament. It shouldn't be there or anything like that. But I will tell you this. It gives a variation of the resurrection account. And you know what? It agrees on crucifixion, resurrection on the third day, Mary Magdalene as first witness. And it doesn't seem to have drawn from any of these other sources, totally independent of them. So what do you have? Four separate sources, all of which agree on the key details, and three of which have a strange little detail that nobody's going to make up. Strange detail. I'm a mean father who makes my children do something very specific before they watch a movie that comes from a book. And that mean thing that I make my children do is that I make them read the book before they're allowed to see the movie. Okay, that's just rule in our household. You cannot go to see a movie until you read the book. And so that's just one of the rules. So when our oldest daughter was 8, I believe, something like that, she was when the first Narnia movie came out. And so we told her, if you read all 7 of the Narnia books before the movie comes out, then we'll go have a nice kind of fun party afternoon, and you can bring a friend with you, everything like that. So she did. Now her friend, having nicer parents than me, that didn't make her friend read the books. So her friend hadn't read any of the books, okay? And so there comes that very powerful scene, very well done, in that particular film in which the White Witch kills Aslan. And the kids are just mesmerized by it, and especially Lacey is just kind of, my daughter's friend Lacey is kind of just clearly terrified by this, that Aslan's dead. And so I hear Hannah lean over to Lacey and say, "Don't worry, I read the book. He doesn't stay dead." Now that's, and I was stuck in my mind, is that's really what we're proclaiming when we're proclaiming the gospel, is simply that, is don't worry, I read the book and he doesn't stay dead. This tragedy that seems from a human perspective to be a tragedy is not a tragedy, but is God's glory and God's power being revealed. And then he demonstrates that he really was revealing his glory and power by raising Jesus from the dead. And here's what that means practically for you. Is that means, you think about it, that it was the darkest and most awful death that could be died in that day. It was viewed by the Greeks and the Romans as a curse in the sense of something vulgar and nasty. It was viewed by the Jews as being cut off from the community. It was viewed in the darkest terms, and not only that, the wrath of God is poured out on Jesus. And yet God turns that into an expression of his power and glory. Here's what that means, is that in your life, you can think of the darkest and nastiest thing that's happened. I don't know what that may be, but you think of the darkest, nastiest thing that's happened. If God could turn the cross into something to bring glory to himself, there is something God can do through whatever it is in you. There's something God can do through that. Now, does that mean that whatever happened or whatever was done or whatever you did was good? No, no. No, it's not saying that it somehow justifies any of that. But what it is saying is that whatever it is, God can use it and work through it to bring glory to himself. He can use it in that way. And so to look at that and try to ask yourself, not remaining in a situation if there's anything like that. I'm not saying that somehow it's good. Don't know what your situations may be. But I'm saying you can look at it and say, God, what is it you want to do through this? What do you want to do through this? If you can turn the cross into an expression of your power and glory, God, what can you do with this? Because there's nothing that God is incapable of working through. And he showed it by he himself sharing in our pain, sharing in our sorrow, experiencing heaped on himself all the pain we've experienced. He experiences that and turns it into glory. And he may not turn it into glory in a way that we see quite like an empty tomb in this life, but he will, and he is turning it into something glorious and wonderful. And it may not be till the end of time that we see that. That God can take anything and turn it for his glory. Not because what was done was good, but because he is good and he is powerful over all things. Does anyone have any questions or anything like that? Before I ask that and let you say anything or anything like that, I want you to be able to think on that for a little bit, because sometimes it takes you a little while to formulate, and that's okay. And in the meantime, there's three papers, that have a green dot on them. So if you can, if you've got one of a green dot one, so see if you can find one that's a green dot paper. So there's three of them have just a little green dot in the upper part of them. Three of you got one? Okay. Can you pass this back to her, please? There we go. Anybody else? All right, you got a green dot? Okay. Awesome. You should have one more. You got one? All right, there you go. All right, good deal. So anyway, just some giveaways and things like that of a book that I just finished and just got published just a few weeks ago. So anyway, so that's just come out. So hopefully enjoy that, use that, or pass it on if you aren't going to use it or whatever like that. So, all right. Anyone have any questions? Anyone? Questions or anything like that? Any questions? No? Okay. Anyone have any questions? As you're thinking through processing, yeah. Okay, I really like Tim Keller's new book, The King's Cross. That's really, I think it's a really good book on that. In terms of apologetics type things, there's a book that I've written called Conspiracies in the Cross that has a lot to do with some of the stuff. It's called Conspiracies in the Cross, and it looks at all the different other possibilities of what might have happened to Jesus and says, okay, here's why the New Testament story actually does make the most sense out of all the different possibilities. And so Conspiracies in the Cross, King's Cross by Tim Keller. There's the old classic book that I think is still a really good book, John R.W. Stott, The Cross of Christ. I mean, that's just a great book. 20, 30 years after it's published, it's still, and it's simply set forth, and it's a really good book. But I would say pick up some of those. Those would be a few that I would say to look at. Anybody else? Yes?
You teach younger students, right?
I do, yes. I teach first, second graders. That's what I do.
How do you explain the cross to them?
I think that we have, and I just, I tell people, this is jokingly, but somewhat truthful too. I say, I go in every week to try to destroy their self-esteem. Now, I don't really mean that in quite the way it sounds, but I do tell them every single week, every story we tell, we end up on Jesus. And I say something to the effect of that none of us, not me, not you, not any of us, even wants to do what's good. We are all sinners. And we are all, because of our sin, we're enemies of God. And the only way we can be made right with God is that Jesus died on the cross in our place. Because we deserve to die forever, eternally. I don't say eternally, I say die forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. That's what I say. But we deserve to die forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. That's what all of us deserve. But Jesus took that forever and ever death on himself on the cross in our place. And the only way we can be made right with God is for us to trust in Jesus. There's nothing we can do. We can just trust in Jesus. And that's all. I mean, I will go through that every single week with the kids. And I'm just very blunt about it, that I don't want, in myself, I don't want to obey Jesus. You don't want to obey Jesus. And the funny thing is, kids sometimes, I had one kid that actually started arguing with me about that. He said, I want to obey Jesus, and I've never done anything wrong. And so it was funny because it was very clear that it was just such a clear expression of what adults may think, but they don't say it. But this kid just said it. I don't want to obey Jesus, and I've never done anything wrong. And it was just that type of a thing, so we talked through it. So it was just funny. I said, well, really? So okay. So I just kind of tried to dialogue with him right there and just said, your mom ever told you to do something, you didn't do it? Yeah. Do you remember a little bit ago, why'd you push that person? Well, you wanted something they had, and you were willing to hurt them to get it. Is that wrong? Yeah, and it's wrong. And so I just tried to help him sort of work through that. And I said, you know what? I'm the same way in my heart, where I wish I could push people out of the way. And sometimes in my life, in other ways, I do that. And that's what all of us are. We're all sinners before God. And that's why. And so just worked from there. But it was kind of funny because he said what I think adults may think, but they don't say. But he was blunt about it. But I think that had we proclaimed what we often do, which is to act like, everybody's okay with God until you get about 8, 9 years old, and then we start talking about something else, that you're not okay with God. When we do that, then we don't get to those real heart issues that we got. He was like 7 years old, and he's wrestling with that. We helped get to a heart issue on that I think God may use later in that. And I really believe that we need to do that, because I think what we do sometimes is we act like kids are right with God until they get to a certain age, and we start telling them they're not right with God, and they wonder, whoa, what happened onto that? But that's because we lied to them. We lied to them earlier, and we need to tell them the truth from the beginning, that you're not right with God, and yet God has made a way through Jesus for people to be saved. It's a great question. Yes? Oh, okay. It's God made the world good, and then sin made the world groan. Jesus broke the power of sin, and God will make the world new. And so we just do that every week almost with them to get them. So, and then we ask, now, today's story, where does it fit? Does it go between creation and fall? Does it go between fall and redemption? We don't use those words. Where does it fit? Or does it go between now and that and the end of time? Where does it fit? So that helps them see the Bible as a big story, one big story, instead of seeing the Bible as a whole bunch of little stories. And so they see the whole big story, and then we talk about today's lesson fits here between God making, between sin making the world groan and Jesus breaking the power of sin. It fits in between those, and so, or whatever we might be. So that's what we do to make sure that they understand the big picture every single week. Yeah. Yes. I think we have to, that's when we really have to lean into the fact that God has, God through Jesus Christ, he suffers with those, he is actually, he's taken on himself the pain of those who are hurting, of those who are fatherless, of those who are dealing with all these things, that God took that pain on himself, that you're not alone. You may feel alone at times, but you're not alone if you for those who have trusted Jesus Christ. He took that on himself. I think we have to emphasize that, and they I think, understand that. I found in other cultures often they understand it better than people in our culture if we tell it to them as a story. And especially I would encourage you learning to tell the big story of the Bible, learning to tell that you know, from Adam, you know, from Adam to Jesus, be able to tell that story and just real briefly, but be able to tell that whole story to them, because the chances are that they are going to be children who pick up very quickly and very easily on stories in ways that children here don't, because they very possibly, depending on where you're at, very possibly are a more oral culture, a speaking culture, as opposed to a written culture. And so they're going to pick that up very, very well. And so to learn, there's some things called chronological Bible storying. And if you can get some materials on chronological Bible storying, it teaches you to tell the Bible story from beginning to end all the way through and maybe use pictures. And they pick up on that. I worked with Native American children at one time, and they are that well way where they pick up on that really quickly and easily, where they can tell you that story back very, very well. And so that's another thing to pick up on and help them see the centrality of Jesus in that, that all this leads up to Jesus, the whole thing does, and it helps them really understand it. It really does. Yeah, and to talk about them, this is the big story that makes sense of all the other stories. This is the one big story. That makes sense of all the other stories. All the stories of all people everywhere somehow are either people rebelling against this story because they don't like this story, or people joining the story. And think of it in those terms, especially with older children, that everybody in all everybody everywhere throughout all time is either trying to fight against this story or is joining this story, one or the other. And that's the story of humanity, is helping them see that in the terms of a story. Yeah. Anybody else? One. All right. Thank you for being here, and I hope you have a great time.